Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Dave Keetrees. I am in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at Rutgers School of Health Professions, Rutgers Biomedical and Health Sciences. Rutgers is the State University of New Jersey. And I am here today to talk about managing chronic pain. As a physical therapist, I treat patients in an HIV clinic, in a multidisciplinary clinic. So in a lot of the patients I see are because they are experiencing chronic pain. I also perform research in the disability and rehabilitation issues related to people living with HIV, with a particular interest in HIV-related peripheral neuropathy. This talk, this workshop, is very much connected to my Rutgers colleague's talk of earlier today. Petros Linovas talked on addiction this morning, and it's very germane to this workshop. Drug use is a risk factor for having chronic pain. It's also a risk factor for increased severity of chronic pain. And on the flip side of that, having chronic pain increases the risk for drug use disorders. All right, so it really kind of, that goes in both directions. Now, because I teach at Rutgers, I teach a lot, and I couldn't resist creating a few PowerPoint slides as a result. So rest assured, though, they're few in number, and I just generated them to create a context for the discussion and kind of frame this talk a little bit. In other words, this will not be death by PowerPoint, because that would not be a very kind way to wrap up this clinical care conference. So just to set the stage a little bit, what is chronic pain? So chronic pain, basically pain lasting for more than 3 months in duration without a specific ongoing injury that it can be ascribed to. Chronic pain is usually not attributable to a single specific patho-anatomical cause, and it's also not correlated with specific findings on diagnostic images. In fact, often people that have chronic pain undergo diagnostic imaging and then are sometimes misled into thinking that the sole cause of their chronic pain is that herniated disc or the stenosis in their spine or something of that nature. Chronic pain develops in some individuals, and it's associated with neuroplastic transformations. What that means is that there are changes in the nervous system, both in the peripheral nervous system and in the central nervous system. So peripherally, what we see is a lowered threshold for nociception in the primary afferent nerve fibers. That's as a result of exposure of those nerve endings to inflammatory cytokines that might be circulating around after some trauma or injury or event, as well as receptor-mediated sensitization of those primary afferents. So in the periphery, what happens is we have phenomenon known as hyperalgesia and allodynia developing. And hyperalgesia is when the amount of pain that you perceive or experience as a result of some noxious stimulus seems elevated out of proportion relative to the amount of stimulus, right? You're sort of hypersensitized. And allodynia is when you experience pain in response to a stimulus that is just not normally painful at all. So just brushing your face with your fingers, for example. Central sensitization occurs in the spinal cord and brain level. And here we see changes in glutamate receptors, ion channel properties, and also synthesis of new proteins occurring. So, you know, we've heard the old adage when people have chronic pain that it's all in their head, right? Well, not true, but partly sort of true if we think of it in the context of central sensitization. There actually are chemical and physiologic changes occurring in the brain that propagate this chronic pain. So in that way, at least partially, it is somewhat in their head, but not imaginary and not fabricated. It's actually related to actual chemical and physiological changes. Chronic pain pathways are one of three things that are usually sort of driving the emergence of chronic pain. It could be nociception, which is a noxious stimulus, or inflammation, and then finally neuropathic pain. So those kind of three things often inform the development of chronic pain, and in many individuals can overlap. So why are we having this discussion today? Because chronic pain prevalence in people living with HIV is a massive problem. The prevalence estimates are somewhere between 39 and 85%. So even if you go with the modest or the conservative end of that, 39%, that's more than a third. And if you go with the more high end of that estimate, it's almost everybody, right? And what are the sources of chronic pain in people living with HIV? Well, there are a lot of different sources potentially. It could be musculoskeletal chronic pain, such as pain coming from the low back, or arthralgias, or myalgias. Chronic pain can also come from the nerves, so distal sensory polyneuropathy, other types of neuropathy seen in people living with HIV disease. So neuropathic pain comes in second place. And then we have some other causes of chronic pain as well, fibromyalgia, chronic headaches, non-specific chronic pain, when a person truly has chronic pain, but you really can't ascertain whether it's coming from joints or muscles or peripheral nerves. And part of the reason for that is that in many people, there are multiple sources of chronic pain. Having chronic pain is certainly no fun because it increases the odds tenfold that one will experience physical function impairments and disability, right? So chronic pain and disability and quality of life are very tightly linked, as if having chronic pain itself isn't bad enough. Now, this study just published about a year and a half ago by Zhao et al. In the journal Pain just generated this pie chart that sort of shows you the relative proportions, right? So we see in people living with HIV disease, if they have chronic pain, where is it coming from? Well, we see spinal and arthralgia, which is joints. Often the most common joint involved would be the hips, but it could also be knees, shoulders, etc., right? Followed by neuropathic pain. And then we also see unspecified pain, explaining a decent size of this pie. And then finally, smaller contributors to the chronic pain picture are headache, pain directly attributable to myalgia or muscle pain. And finally, I had to make the font so small because that piece of the pie is pretty small, is pelvic pain. So, again, we're having this discussion today because chronic pain is associated with both modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. Some of these things we just can't do anything about, right? Age, for example. People are getting older. That's a risk factor. Not a whole lot we can do about that. Other risk factors are sex. Being of the female sex is a risk factor for both the prevalence and severity of chronic pain. HIV infection itself, being on antiretroviral drugs as far as potential side effects or toxicity from some of the antiretrovirals. Chronic inflammation and immune system activation, which we see in most individuals living with HIV disease, and might also be the reason for the phenomenon of premature or accelerated aging. And multimorbidity or other health problems, such as cardiovascular disease, metabolic bone disease, diabetes, non-AIDS-defining malignancies, and frailty. We see multimorbidity in the majority of people who have chronic pain, about 60%, 60 to 70% of them, in addition to their chronic pain, are going to have one of these other morbidities as well. Psychological status, such as depression, anxiety, coping strategies, fear and avoidance, catastrophizing patterns of behavior or patterns of thought, secondary gain, and then also social factors, cultural factors, lifestyle factors, such as lack of support systems, the stigma, right? So having HIV disease is still widely stigmatized in our society. Chronic pain also carries its own special stigma, right? So we really have multiple layers of stigma going on here. Work status and then compensation dependency is also a factor in chronic pain. Okay, so in other words, it's complicated, all right? It's a very rich picture of different risk factors and different sources of chronic pain. One thing we know pretty well by now is that the straightforward biomedical model of pharmaceutical alone does not work well for patients with chronic pain, right? If there was some simple pill that didn't have toxicity and that didn't have side effects that we could give someone to make their chronic pain go away, we obviously would, okay? It just doesn't exist. Another reason we're having this discussion is because, as you know, we are in the midst of an unprecedented opioid epidemic in the United States. And another reason that we're having this discussion today is that even when opioids are judiciously and appropriately prescribed and monitored, right, even when those conditions exist, they haven't been proven to be effective in the management of chronic pain, right? They cause side effects in most individuals of some nature, including constipation, for example, being one of the most common. Long-term use of opioids can actually lead to paradoxical hyperalgesia, and opioids will lose their effect over time. People develop tolerance, and therefore the dosage is going to need to be ramped up. And even when appropriately prescribed and monitored, they still pose a risk for physical dependency and addiction. And there are, you know, their own set of risk factors for physical dependency and addiction that Petros was talking about this morning, like genetics and family history and behavior patterns and et cetera. So, again, why are we having this discussion? Well, alternatives to opioids do exist, and that's what we're going to talk about today partly. We really need to consider them for chronic pain management in people living with HIV disease. Treatment of chronic pain requires consideration of not just their biology or their physiology, but also the biopsychosocial model, which includes mental health factors, depression, anxiety, and social factors, support factors, coping strategies, etc. The focus in treating someone with chronic pain is to not propose to them that you have a magic wand that's going to make their pain completely go away. Instead, we want to teach them how to manage and cope with their chronic pain, hopefully lessen it as well, but focus on functional goals, coping skills, and enhancement of quality of life. This requires a comprehensive approach that addresses, in many individuals, the multiple mechanisms of chronic pain. Okay? And before we launch into our discussion, we're going to do a little activity, all right? And we'll do it first, and then I'll kind of explain why we're doing it, all right? So what I want everybody to do is to sit and just uncross your legs if they're crossed, put both feet on the ground, hip width apart, nice comfortable seating posture, and I want you to look straight ahead. You could look at this beautiful graphic that I lifted off the internet without copyright permission. And as you inhale, keep your eyes open. As you exhale, just close your eyelids. On the next inhalation, open your eyelids, and as you exhale, close your eyelids. And continue to repeat that for a couple of cycles, opening your eyes as you inhale, closing your eyes as you exhale. The next time you open your eyes, also, instead of looking at the graphic, gaze up at the ceiling. Roll your eyes up, and then as you close your eyelids and exhale, relax your eyes. Open your eyelids and gaze up as far as you can. Close your eyes and relax. Repeat that a couple more cycles. Gaze up while your eyes are open, and relax as you close your eyes. Okay, good. Now, what you did just now was a little bit of self-hypnosis. It's a technique to help induce some relaxation, a deeper state of relaxation. All right? And the first time I was sitting in a... I'm so susceptible, so vulnerable to being hypnotized. I was sitting in the class, I just like one breath in and out, and I was like asleep. But it's something that we want to think about as a alternative therapy in the context of the biopsychosocial model of treating chronic pain, one strategy in the domain of complementary and alternative therapies is hypnosis. Okay? So our talks today are, how can we help our patients manage their chronic pain without using opioids? And we also want to talk about how we can reduce or eliminate opioid use in patients who have been taking prescription opioids for an extended periods of time. Those were the two questions put forward for this workshop by the planners of today's clinical conference. What I actually want to do, though, is go out of order, and I want to jump to the second one because Petros was talking about this quite a bit this morning. So this is kind of a natural segue maybe to talk about this first. How can we reduce or eliminate opioid use in patients? Now, Petros was talking about it in a slightly different context. He was talking about misuse of drugs and addiction, right, to prescription opioids or addiction to heroin. But we can sort of apply that same model to getting people to reduce or eliminate opioid use. We have medications that can be used for addiction, right? We also have group support programs, like 12-step types of programs, so group support. And then there's also motivational interviewing, which kind of segues to cognitive behavioral therapeutic approaches. So talk therapy, group support, and in some cases for people that actually have addiction issues, you know, medications as well that can be helpful. So what I'd like to do next is just sort of open this up to the floor for questions, for comments. Of the two questions we're going to be talking about today, this is probably one where I'm going to be learning more from you than you're learning from me, right? When we get on to the next question, I'll hopefully have some insights and some information to offer there and share with you as well. So as we go around the room, if you want to, you kind of just raise your hand and then we'll bring the microphone to you. Please wait until you have the microphone in your hand so that your question is recorded and so that everyone can hear your question. And also before your question or your comment, just tell us your name and kind of where you're from and if you have any particular context that you'd like to share that is motivating your question or your comment, you could feel free to share as well. Okay, so anybody thoughts? And we have okay, in the front row first, and then we'll come back to you. Okay.
I'm Ann Fitzgerald. I'm a nurse practitioner from Omaha, Nebraska.
Hi, Ann.
And the reason I came to this workshop is because I'm trying to avoid prescribing opioids for my patients with chronic pain, but I realize they've got chronic pain.
Right.
And so I want to give them something else to deal with their chronic pain. And I have chronic pain, so I know what it feels like.
Yep.
But I want to treat their chronic pain, and it's very hard when they're on the phone going, just give me a pill, give me a pill, I want a pill. And it's like, no,
right.
I want you to see a physical therapist. I want to prescribe something. Or I want them to try an anti-inflammatory, but I don't want them to take an anti-inflammatory because their blood pressure is elevated, or there's some other reason. So I guess I'm looking for ways to try and convince my patients that there are other options other than a pill to help them with their chronic pain, because I feel very helpless to help them. Because it's like, I'm not going to give you opioids, but I want to give you another option.
Right. So absolutely. So the public in general is mostly oriented to the biomedical model. Like, if you're sick, there's a pill that's going to make you better. So there's sort of that phenomenon going on. And then we also have the phenomenon up until about 10 years ago where opioids were overprescribed for patients with chronic pain, right? So that added, and that kind of fueled that, is that many people in the public think that if their chronic pain is bad enough, the solution to that is a strong painkiller, right? And just the name, painkiller, it creates an illusion that it's going to make their pain go away and that it's going to solve their problem. So I think there are some alternatives, and we'll kind of come back, we'll circle back to those in the last 20 minutes or so of our talk. But I think how do you get there, right, is you have to find a way in and have a conversation with your patient and educate them. And I think some of that is just first disclosing what we know about opioids. Number one, they don't have any proven effectiveness in successfully managing chronic pain. They create some very bad side effects, right, that could get worse over time. So sort of talk about all the bad things, right, that are exist at opioids, and then talk about the alternatives, right? And there are places and times when opioids maybe still are appropriate in people with chronic pain. So I think it's just a matter of kind of being open and disclosing the alternatives. Yeah, but thanks for that. That is a big struggle with the public. Yeah, and were you next? Yeah. I think, front row.
You mentioned that you have an interest in peripheral neuropathy that's HIV related. And I think one of the things that I really struggle with is people who have that from either HIV or the drugs that they used to take, and their old prescribers would give them opiates for that.
Yes.
That's a really big problem that I have.
It's a huge problem.
In the context of that. So I offer gabapentin and duloxetine and nortriptyline. Mm-hmm. To me, that, like, I'm not aware of options other than acupuncture that would help with that. What else can I do for them?
Okay, so what's your name and where are you from?
Sorry, I'm Joe Bauer from Tacoma, Washington.
Okay, welcome, thanks. So, right, so I would say, the prevalence of peripheral neuropathy in people living with HIV disease has been, you see a big range of the prevalence in the literature, ranging from 30% to 65%. And of people with peripheral neuropathy, at least half of them experience burning pain as their primary symptom. And it could be unrelenting, and it can progress over time. And most of the patients that I see with peripheral neuropathy were prescribed opioid medication, right? So other medications are anticonvulsants that are often prescribed, Lyrica, Neurontin, Pregaba, Gabapentin. The problem is that there is efficacy for anticonvulsants in diabetic neuropathy pain, but it hasn't been shown to have an effect in HIV-related peripheral neuropathy. Now, that being said, there have only been two studies, one of GABA and one of pre-GABA. So only two studies. So based on that, it might still be worth a try. And the same thing goes for tricyclic antidepressants, particularly if your patient has concurrent depression, is that might be worth exploring as well. Generally, anti-inflammatories don't help with peripheral neuropathic pain. And So what I do clinically is I don't do acupuncture or dry needling. If I had it available to me in New Jersey in the clinic, I would do it. But in New Jersey, physical therapists just recently can no longer do dry needling. And we don't have an acupuncturist in our clinic. But those things could be tried as well. Other things are exercise, intensive exercise programs. And again, that's one that we have to extrapolate from the diabetic literature. So there is some evidence emerging that in people with diabetic peripheral neuropathy, that intensive exercise programs over a long period of time can really be helpful, not only in reducing their symptoms, but also improving the health of the peripheral nerves. When they do, in a pilot study out of Patty Kluding's lab in Iowa, they actually did skin punch biopsies pre-post and post in a period of intensive exercise. The axonal density actually improved on a skin punch biopsy. And now there's a multi-site study going on right now in Kansas and Iowa that's kind of looking at a bigger, much bigger RCT to look at intensive exercise. Also, TENS, transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, is something that I do with virtually every patient that I see that comes into the clinic that has peripheral neuropathy for a couple reasons. One is that it does have efficacy for non-HIV-related peripheral neuropathy pain, right? It's never been studied in HIV-related peripheral neuropathy, but there is an effect in diabetic neuropathy. So worth a try, and I've found anecdotally that at least half of my patients that I do it with get a positive result and a clinically meaningful reduction in their pain perception. And that means a lot to them, right? And in the patients that don't, oh, well, you know, no harm done. There's no adverse side effects. There's no overdosing. There's no dependency. The worst thing that happens is it doesn't work. The other nice thing about TENS now is that back when I was in physical therapy school, right, you know, back in the dark ages, TENS was like relatively new. This is like 35 years ago. And a TENS unit cost $400 or $500 or $600, right? You can get a TENS unit now online without a prescription for less than $20, right? So we, you know, just keep a box of them in the clinic and hand them out like Halloween candy. And, you know, with training and education, because patients have to know how to optimize the use with the electrode placements and what to do when the electrodes dry out and that kind of thing. So that's something to consider as well. But, yeah, thanks. But that's a really big problem, is that people with peripheral neuropathy, if they were diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy more than a year or two ago, they're probably still on opioids.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So,
the exercise that you just mentioned,
yeah.
A follow-up. How intense is that exercise?
So in the diabetic neuropathy study,
yes.
It was intense, like moderate intensity on the Borg scale of perceived exertion. So sort of on that scale that, depending on your own perception, which correlates with maximal heart rate, they were working at a moderate intense exercise level, which was somewhat controversial in patients with diabetic neuropathy. There was a concern that because of the insensate skin on their feet, that it might create wounds or sores, but it didn't. Right? It really appeared to, in that pilot study, it appeared to be safe, and that's why they're looking at it now in a bigger randomized control trial. Yeah. Another question over here?
I'm sorry. Just to piggyback, does insurance cover the TENS units, or do they have to buy it out of pocket?
Do insurance companies cover TENS units, or do you have to buy it out of pocket? So it depends on the insurance company, right? So it is something that some carriers will cover. If it's not covered, at least it's affordable, you know, generally less than $20. And if you've got, you know, a little bit of grant funding, so in the clinic where I see patients, you know, we bought some with some funds that we have so that we can give them out at nominal cost to patients. And then the only thing they really have to buy is they just have to order new electrodes if the electrodes dry out. And they could order those online as well. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask more of the counseling piece for individuals, for patients who have been on long-acting opioids for a long time. Their pain is controlled, so there's no, it doesn't appear that there's any diversion.
Uh-huh.
They are stable on it. And of course, now in Maryland, we have new rules. It's really quite complex. Have to get contracts, there's quite a bit of documentation as to why we would need to keep somebody on a certain dose. It's really dose related. And I have found it extremely challenging to move the discussion about, you know, like thinking of removing, you know, some of this medicine in people that have been stable on it. They, you know, they just simply are, will not, you know, they're almost, you know, unmovable in having discussions about what other things that we might be able to use. You know, because we have someone where we could refer and we could do slow taper of their opioid and try to introduce other things.
Right.
The other challenge is for some of our clinics, including mine, our patients are very poor, and anything that where there is a copay or out of pocket, we have difficulty with. Although I love your idea of buying some TENS units, I think that could help.
So those are both big issues. So one is, you know, for those patients whose chronic pain does appear to be successfully managed with long-term opioid use, and they're not, you know, showing any signs of diverting the meds or misusing the meds, and they're keeping with their agreement or their contract, and their urine screens show that they're taking the medications as prescribed, then, you know, that might be a scenario where, okay, how hard do you need to put, do you want to push, or is it necessary to push to get them off of the opioid meds? I mean, as long as they're aware of the potential side effects, and then they're aware of the fact that there are some other options they can explore, but they have to be ready to go there. And lots of times, they're really not. You can use motivational interviewing to try to facilitate their readiness to explore other options. But even when you do that, if they're happy with how they're doing on the opioids, right, that might be a situation where it's not really worth aggressively pursuing a change. And, you know, the opioids are covered. Right? So to go to yoga, to go to the hypnotist, right?
Extra
money. Even to go to physical therapy. So certain, you know, HMOs in New Jersey, the copay for a physical therapy visit is $60 for a visit, right? That's the copay. So a lot of people really can't afford a lot of these things. You know, going to see someone for a private Reiki session, $100 an hour, right? Or a private massage session, things of that nature. There is a definitely emergence of a consideration of self-management programs for people with HIV-related chronic pain. That self-management model has already been nicely developed for other chronic diseases, but we're starting to gain some traction now in people living with HIV disease. And it's still sort of something new. The idea here with self-management is to have an educational platform to reduce the cost and improve the accessibility. You could do group classes. You could have online platforms. You could have apps. So I have a colleague in London, Darren Brown, who developed an app. It's called Be You Positive. B-E-Y-O-U, and then a plus sign. And it's in the Google App Store, and I think it costs like $2. And it provides people with education, resources, links. They could put in their, if they want, they could put in their own values for CD4 counts and viral loads and sort of track their own stuff. It's not a back-and-forth exchange of HPI. It's really, once they download it, then they kind of use it on their own device. But self-management is a way of trying to enhance people's coping skills and what they can really do at low cost or on their own to help improve their situation, improve their quality of life, and manage their pain. And so, for example, one way you can do some low-cost behavioral therapy, like mindfulness meditation, is to go to YouTube and type in, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn mindfulness meditation body scan, and, you know, put on your headphones and no cost, right? It's free. It's available, widely available. So, you know, we're kind of looking at that. Right now, my colleague in Toronto, Kelly O'Brien, is doing an RTC of a self-management program for people living with HIV disease. Many people in the study, enrolled in the study, have chronic pain. What she did was provided people with a membership to the YMCA, relatively low cost compared to going to formal physical therapy one-on-one three times a week. The participants had a couple training sessions initially, right, with study staff on how to safely perform exercises and how to gauge their exercise level. And then they're getting educational materials to supplement that. So kind of looking at expanding in the future, I think one thing that we're really looking at trying to expand is this concept of self-management programming that can be available somewhat electronically or at a very low cost. Because that really is a good point, is that, you know, and it's ironic, too, is that, you know, you can get a prescription for pain medications, and if you take a few too many, you'll be dead, right? But that's covered by your insurance, by your prescription plan in most cases, right? And these alternatives are often only partially covered or not covered at all, and can be kind of costly. You know, you'll sometimes see community centers that offer low-cost yoga classes for people specifically living with HIV disease in the Philadelphia and New Jersey area. We have a couple of those. And, you know, it's a matter of getting people motivated to go, to seek them out, to find them.
Yes, I have a patient that he was in every single opioid that you can imagine in narcotics.
He was using a lot of opioids.
Yes.
Narcotics.
Yes. So basically, I started tapering him off from everything. Now he's only on whatever the pain specialist recommended, because I was like, I mean, I was highly suspicious of him being using the medication to obtain a different gain. I drug tested him. I inherited this person, so I drug tested him three times, and two of them, he was negative for everything but methadone and heroin. So obviously, I discontinued everything immediately, but he continued coming every week, harassing the nurses and myself for medications. Long story short, I refer him to pain management. I'd say, well, let's do all this imaging, because imaging was dated from probably 2007, nothing else done in all this uh-huh. time. Obviously, he initially was prescribed this because he sustained a fall from a 20-foot ladder.
Uh-huh.
So obviously, some, you know, history there. But at this point, I just, like, you're out of my hands. I'm sending you to pain management. They recommended the pregabalin, the gabapentin,
uh-huh.
amitriptyline, you name it. I did even Topamax. So I did everything that they been recommended, but this guy continues coming and saying no relief with anything. So I even refer him to psych. At this point, I don't know what else to do. So what would you suggest?
Well, so that classify under like the difficult patient, right?
Yes.
You inherit a patient from another clinic. They're coming with their baggage. You're coming with the history of being overprescribed opioids, having, if not a physical dependency, but emotional attachment to the opioids, and a belief that that's what they need and that's what they want, and that's the end of the story. So it really is a challenge. You know, if you do prescribe opioids in that situation, it would have to be under an agreement and carefully monitored. You know, again, you could explore motivational interviewing to try to convince them that there are some alternatives and of the hazards of long-term opioid use. But it becomes increasingly hard to do that in a patient with a long history. And there are patients that just have their heels dug in the sand so deeply that you can motivationally interview them out the wazoo, and you're not going to change their mind. They want their Percocets, and
Correct.
They want their oxycodone, and you know, you just you have to just handle it the best you can. It's never easy. There are patients that will start to act out as well in those scenarios, and you have to be careful not to reinforce those behaviors in a way that makes it conducive to them doing more of that behavior in the future.
Right.
You know. So yeah, it really is a challenge. I wish I had a recommendation or an easy solution for that. Does anybody have any thoughts that they can share on sort of handling that difficult patient? Go ahead.
There you go.
Hi, Jim Zachary from Austin. I think this guy is you just need to leave him in the hands of the pain management guy. Clearly, he has a lot of risk factors for doing poorly, and this is what a pain management specialist is for. So if the pain management specialist has gone through all the options and the guy still hasn't responded, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's a sort of a choice between this guy killing himself or maybe living with some chronic pain. And, you know, I would frankly choose for the guy to continue to survive. That's my perspective. That's what I would do.
Yeah. So just to tag along with that, and I left out some history of drug.
You passed over from like that?
So, sorry, I left out the history of drug abuse on him, but he's been in remission for probably 10, 20 years. That's the reason he was on methadone. So basically the pain specialist also recommended Suboxone. So I use the argument of potential relapse to be referring him to a Suboxone clinic. At that time, we were not doing Suboxone in our clinic, so he has been declined to be taken as a client just because he's not currently using. So now I'm like, okay, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, one more.
Sorry.
Then I would go online, get the Suboxone certification, and then use Suboxone for his pain.
Thank you for your talk. I just had a question along the same lines. I've got kind of this percentage of patients who are adopted, they've been on opioids, and I've tried this approach. And these are people, again, they're not, you know, kind of out there drug users. Some of these people work. They say, I need this to get to work and do my job and to function. So sometimes it becomes such a part of their kind of daily routine. And I can, understanding kind of the world has shifted now to the opioid epidemic, I mean, I think it's hard to class those people in this. I mean, they seem to be focusing on the young people in the Rust Belt who are all strung out on heroin. Well, there's people who actually, you know, function, have jobs, they go to work, they pay taxes, blah, blah, blah,
oh, yeah.
And this is a part of their life. So is it, I mean, my thing is, like as you said, I mean, it's hard because I feel like in the medical community we're divided. Some providers are like, well, no, we can't give them at all to anybody, right? But then you have these people who are your patients who look you in the face, and they have other chronic medical illnesses. They have diabetics, hypertensive. They take their other medicines. They get their labs done. They do everything you ask them to do. And they are on, you know, and I have some there. I mean, they might take 60 Vicodin in 2 months, right? That's what they use. When it's bad, they take it. Some days they don't use it. I mean, I think it's sometimes unfair to throw those folks in with this group and demonize providers who give those medicines to those people, those patients. They're not having any side effects. I think, like you're saying, it's important to understand who's the one who maybe at this risk, and obviously these folks, even with mild use, probably have some dependence. And I tell my patients all the time who are on them, every time I write it, you know about this, et cetera, but then we try to weigh the risk and benefits. So my question, I know it's a long soapbox speech, forgive me, everybody, but when you have that patient who maybe is buying into this, they're on, you know, they get Norco or something, they're getting 60 a month or 90 a month or whatever, how do you taper? I mean, what's the how much time, you know, I'm saying, do you go down, say, 10% a month? You just cut it in half? I mean, what's been your experience? Because my approach is to bring in these other modalities at the same time, trying to taper them down, and then let them understand they may have chronic pain the rest of their lives. I was telling them that. You're going to probably have pain the rest of your life, but the issue is, how's that pain affecting your ability to function and do what you need to do in your quality of life, right? Because my speech that I begin with this is, you've been on these pills for 10 years. Are you any better than you were with the day you started them? No, I still got to get up and take them. So they haven't helped improve your problem.
Right. They're not more functional. They haven't achieved goals through taking pain medication. They haven't improved their quality of life often.
So I'm curious, have you been successful with some of your patients, I mean, going from high level to zero, or you get high level to just a low level, they might get one prescription every 3 months, and that's fine, and use it here and there, and what's acceptable, and I guess the rate, and anybody in the room has any comments or experience with that?
I'm going to ask that question of people in the audience, because as a physical therapist, I don't make decisions about tapering painkillers or opioids. So I'm sure some people in the room do have some thoughts, though. But, and before... Is that me?
Yeah.
Okay. So the pendulum has swung, right? It used to be like everybody was on opioids, right? And now, like, opioids are, you know, like the demon seed, right? And lots of bad progress. There are people, right, that are not at risk for addiction, who are functioning, who are maybe good candidates for continued opioid use. You know, it's a reality, and I think the pendulum's probably going to end up balancing somewhere, you know, at some point with that. The other thing, and before we get to the audience answering your question about tapering, is that, you know, there are also people, and this kind of comes back to your question as well, people who have a proclivity to substance abuse or an addiction history. That's not an absolute contraindication to opioid therapy, prescribed and monitored opioid therapy for their chronic pain. Because if they have chronic pain and you don't manage it in some appropriate way, then guess what they're at risk for doing? Is self-medicating and going out onto the street and shooting heroin or God knows what else. So, you know, there's even a time and a place, I think, to use pain medication and opioids judiciously, even with people who have a risk of addiction or a history of substance use. So, but with that, I want to, can anybody in the audience speak to tapering schedules? In the back row to start?
Hello, my name is Nada Fadol. I'm from Greenville, North Carolina. And before that, I did palliative care and cancer pain management at MD Anderson. I don't really have a specific answer to the tapering question, but I wanted to go back to that scenario that you mentioned, is that in managing these patients, even with cancer patients, there are patients who do abuse opioids and, you know, they're survivors of cancer with chronic pain, and you run into these problems even with cancer pain. Even sometimes people try to exclude that entity, but it's truly not any different than other chronic pains. So with these patients, I think it's very important to establish the expectations ahead of time. Uh-huh. You know, so you talk about goals. What are your goals from your pain management, and what can I offer you? And the key here is what you mentioned earlier, is function. You know, these medicines are supposed to improve your function. And if the medicine is doing something different than that, then that's when you draw the line and you say, my obligation as a physician is to do no harm. That's my first obligation. And then the second thing is to benefit you. So when I feel that the medicine is actually causing harm and preventing you from functioning or leading you towards dependency or addiction, that's when I draw the line and I say, I can no longer do this and we have to get you off these medications. Now, how do you taper medicine in a patient who's stable on low-dose opioids, like the example you gave? Honestly, I don't try to do that aggressively, because if the patient is functioning, then you can try to use the other modalities, but sometimes if you come in and say, I need to take you off this medicine, then you have an adversarial relationship with your patient, and right, you lose that, you know, connection and the feeling that they care about you care about them. So yeah. I don't try to do that aggressively. I do it very systematically. First you try the other modalities, and then you talk about the opioids.
And I think it's only going to be successful if they're on board with it. You know, if you have a mutual trust with your patient, and they're kind of buying into this idea that, yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of bad things about opioids. I'd like to maybe look at tapering down and see what happens if I do. But any other comments about tapering schedules?
You know, advanced HIV infection. His treatment for his pain was peripheral neuropathy. When he came to me, he had an outside pain physician. He was on 320 milligrams of OxyContin BID, two fentanyl patches, and had enough medicine for breakthrough pain. Small guy. It's amazing. I mean, and had, and this is a fellow that I practice in Baltimore, Maryland, and he lives in Delaware, and he would come and see me for his treatment. So it took a couple of years to convince him that he should get another pain physician, because this was, he was on way too much medicine. But ultimately, the thing that motivated him was his insurance changed, and all of a sudden this medicine became prohibitively expensive. So he came and saw our psychiatry program, who did the tapering. So I never, you know, so he came in, and it took 2 years to get him off of all, he's off all medicines now. And with the last 3 months of him going in as an inpatient to get the final taper off, and he's been now, he's good for 2 years now. And, you know, he does have neuropathy, but it's manageable. It's this idea, it really, of escalation of doses, because it's not really, doesn't really affect the way it's generated. The pain, the chronic pain is generated. This opioids, I thought that was a classic kind of example of where you could do dose escalation and it really didn't affect it. But it was, I mean, a huge challenge to get him off of that. And it took, it was small. They introduced some other medications as well. But it was a two years. Took 2 years. But off now.
We'll come back to you. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just add my two cents. I have tapered off a few people who were on really, really extraordinarily high amounts of opiates, and I think the key was going slow, several years, two, sometimes 3 years. But just like sometimes I would reduce from, you know, 1 month to the next month, I reduced by like two pills. And it would seem like, okay, we're never going to get anywhere, but slow, slow, slow we have. And people are generally happier. They're happier, they feel better, and all the times that you tell them, believe me, you won't have more pain afterwards, and they really don't until they get there.
And then they're starting to experience, as you said, some of the benefits of not having, being under the influence of opioids as well.
I don't know if people have looked at the Turn the Tide RX website, but it has some really helpful tools for functional assessment, for documentation for people that you want to keep them on, and then you can document that you have been paying attention to that, and then also having them on pain contracts if somebody is stable so that your colleagues can look at that and say, you did put thought into this, and if you're not there, you know, there isn't a whole poop show over getting them the refill, for example. Something that I found really, and then another thing, something that I found really helpful is not discussing the risk for addiction so much, but saying that discussing the risk for hypersensitivity, because I do see that so often, and that takes the conversation away from, well, I'm not an addict, I'm not one of those people, then because that would just, like, people totally dig in there. So I find a lot more success in saying, I don't want to make your pain worse. And I believe you that it works right now. Because then if I say, these medicines don't work, they say, well, it works for me. But I say, that's true, and I totally, you know, when I broke my shoulder, it worked for me. But the thing is, in the long run, this will make your pain worse, and I like you, and I don't want to hurt you. So let's work together, and like maybe you can tell me what kind of plan would feel comfortable for you to taper. So what feels like, if I feel that if I put some control into the patient's hands and they don't have that like desperate need to hang on and they don't feel so defensive about the process.
Right, so shared decision-making there comes into play, getting the patient on board. And, you know, rather than having kind of that one-sided dialogue where you're going to use labels and, you know, create perceptions of stigma on their part and, you know, tell them the way it's going to go, you engage them in the conversation and really motivational interviewing sounds like is what you were talking about there. You know. you, and then we'll come over to you.
Sorry.
Is that good?
Just really quick. excuse me. The website that we use was the VA. They have a pretty reasonable taper. So, and like you say, slow and is better and safe, and also give the patient the opportunity to feel that you're involving them in the care, because that's definitely what needs to happen. Help, like, share decisions and make them feel that you are patient centered care. So,
thank you
As far as the taper, the CDC recommends going from 10% a week to 10% a month, depending on how long they've been on opiates and how much opiates they're using. So there's quite a bit of leeway allowing you to personalize the taper. And then secondly, one thing that I've occasionally had success with in convincing patients to lower their opiate use is talking about some of the serious side effects. The big one is you know, QTC prolongation and sudden death with methadone, for example. And you know, sudden death is it's a serious side effect. And I have had some success with convincing patients to go down.
And it sounds like, so even with that conservative tapering of 10% a month, that theoretically it would only take 10 months, but a couple people have shared that it seems like in reality, even longer, like two or 3 years it can be. Yeah. Uh-huh. Thanks for that. One in the back, and then we'll come up to you, okay? And we'll make yours the last question or comment, and then have a minute to wrap.
Hi, my name is Alina Mayo, and I'm from Washington, D.C., along with Ike, who asked you about the TENS units. And we will make that recommendation at Wainwright, do some, use some grant money for that. But we have inherited hundreds, not 50, not 100, through transition of care. And we have tried to, and we have now incorporated the pain contract.
Hundreds of people on opioids, you mean?
Yes, okay. Hundreds of people on opioids. You know, we take into consideration that there are those that are stable on these opioids. They're not coming in saying that they need their dosage increased or their dispense a, you know, a greater amount, because that's a red flag. Now I'm referring you to pain management to ask for their assistance with this. But we have been threatened. We've had to have, call, had the police come. Mm-hmm. And I'm in D.C., so now we have Homeland Security also. So all these people, you know, they respond to these outbursts. And we have also been told that we would lose a lot of patients if we strongly enforce this new plan of action that we have. And that's what I find a challenge. So I came here today hoping that, or wishing that, you had this guideline that we, that's so successful, that we could help these, you know, because I do have empathy, right? So hoping that we could help them. So I'm grateful to hear that there are others. I mean, which are, we saw some data that showed we're in a crisis and we have a long struggle. And we have to be diligent about this. But I'm grateful. I appreciate some of the things that have been said. I've heard these things before. I just hope that soon everyone buys in, because it's a buy-in. And some people take the route of least resistance, mm-hmm. because our patients will literally leave our office and go downstairs or somewhere else and get what they need. That's all I wanted to say.
It's not an easy problem to solve.
It's not.
It really is not. And one more comment?
I'm Bonnie Van Eyder from Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
One thing that's been helpful is that some of the insurance companies now want prior authorizations for high-dose narcotics. So I've used that as another reason for patients that we really need to start working on lowering the doses, because your insurance company is not going to pay for this soon. And it does get some people's attention.
Uh-huh. That's a good strategy, the financial incentive that you might not be able to afford it at some point down the road. Yeah.
So, okay, well, great. So, you know, we could, I just want to end on time because it is the end of the conference. We could certainly linger around and chat casually after the workshop formally ends. But it sounds like one thing that is a big issue is dealing with people who are on opioids and what we're going to do with them, right? And there are no easy solutions. There may be times when it's not a bad idea to keep people on long-acting opioids or reasonable dose opioids to manage their chronic pain, depending on their individual circumstances, whereas there might be other times when incentives like financial incentives or using motivational interviewing or shared decision-making might help them be ready to try to taper down. And then maybe concurrently with tapering down is offer them some of the alternatives that, you know, if they do have financial restraints, looking at lower cost alternatives like group exercise programs or sort of self-management information that they could access online, or if they do have insurance coverage or just have the, you know, the cash to spend, sending them for, you know, some of the more expensive treatments. Because a lot of these, you know, they're for people with HIV-related chronic pain, many of these things on this list do have evidence to support their efficacy, right? And also with chronic pain in general, mindfulness meditation, hypnosis, yoga for chronic low back pain, dry needling for chronic myofascial pain. So, you know, TENS for diabetic neuropathic pain, and exercise for chronic pain of various etiologies. So, you know, there are alternatives out there. It's a matter of getting patients to connect with one of them, what's affordable to them, and what are they interested in doing, right? You're going to have some patients who just refuse to consider or to try yoga. They feel that it might be in conflict with their spiritual beliefs, that they just, you know, yoga is for girls or something. I don't know why. But people have play tapes in their minds as to why they may or may not want to do certain things. But fortunately, we do have a menu of some options that might be viable options for some of our patients, particularly as if we are trying to taper them and if they are trying to move toward an opioid-free life. All right, one more comment?
I was just going to say, you mentioned earlier about like the YMCA. I've written notes for my patients that say I support them applying to the YMCA for a scholarship.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they can take that note and get a reduced rate at some of the gyms and that type of thing. So that's something else you can do for your patients.
Yeah, and YMCAs are generally the least expensive, you know, type of gym to join. And with a note to get a discount or a scholarship, that's really good. They might just need some sensible guidance then as what to do with the gym, right? You know, depending on who they maybe meet at the gym, they could end up hurting themselves at the gym as much as they could end up helping themselves at the gym. That's something to be aware of, too. All right, thank you so much, everyone, for your time and attention.